Of John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 13. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God.
And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. All things were created through him, and apart from him, not one thing was created that has been created. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. That light shines in the darkness, and yet the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify about the light, so all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he had come to testify about the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was created through him, yet the world did not recognize him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, he gave them the right to be children of God. To those who believe in his name, who were born, not of natural descent, or of the will of the flesh, or of the will of man, but of God. This is the word of the Lord.
For now, we're going to turn our attention to the scriptures. And so if you have a Bible, I'd encourage you to open it to John chapter 1. And during this Advent season, we have been going through John 1 to look at Jesus, to consider Jesus. And we've said just objectively that Jesus is the most important person that has ever lived in all of human history. He has influenced more things in the world, and his influence is directly felt by us. Whether we recognize him, whether we see him as Messiah or not, every single person on the planet has been directly impacted by his life. And so we've been looking at him because if we're going to live in a world that has been impacted by him, we need to understand who he is. And so in the first week, we saw that he is the reason for being, the purpose and meaning for life. And then last week, we saw that he gives people a mission, that there is a purpose and direction to those who follow him in their life. And now this week, we're kind of turning a corner. Because we're going to look at what it looks like when you reject him, when you decide you don't want that mission, when you decide that he is not the Messiah, and you decide that you don't want to follow him. And so there's kind of two parts to this passage. There's what happens when you reject Jesus, and then what happens when you receive him, when you accept him. So John chapter 1, verses 10 through 13. And in verse 10, it says, he was in the world, and the world was created through him, and yet the world did not recognize him. Now, up until verse 10, the Word, that is the pre-existent second person of the Trinity, the Son, who incarnates as Jesus Messiah, the Word, up until verse 10, has been in continuing existence. He has been God, but also distinct from God. He's been coming into the world. But now, in verse 10, we see that he is in the world. But something surprising happens. The world is created through him, and yet the world does not recognize him. Now, we know that in the book of John, the world doesn't just mean a place, but is the way John talks about the organized system of humanity in rebellion against God. And so he's not just talking about he was in the world in general, but he was in proximity to the organized system of rebellion, humans who rejected him. And so the first thing that we see is that those who reject Jesus don't know where they're from. If you don't accept Jesus as creator, then you don't really know where you're coming from, and you have to make it up for yourself. You have to come up with a story that gives meaning and purpose and direction to your life. Because if you don't know where you're from, then you don't know what your purpose is, and you don't know where you're going. And so you end up living a life that is just kind of making it up. Now, there's a really great book called Lost in the Cosmos by Walker Percy. It's called Lost in the Cosmos, The Last Self-Help Book, and it is worth your time. He explores this experience of life. What does it feel like when we disagree with the Christian story and have to make one up for ourselves? And so here's how he describes this experience. With the passing of the cosmological myths and the fading of Christianity as a guarantor of identity of the self becomes dislocated. It is both cut loose and imprisoned by its own freedom, yet imprisoned by a curious and paradoxical bondage like a Chinese handcuff. So that the very attempts to free itself, For example, by ever more refined techniques for the pursuit of happiness, only tighten the bondage and distance the self even further from the very world it wishes to inhabit as its homeland. The rational Jeffersonian pursuit of happiness embarked upon in the American Revolution translates into the flaky euphoria of the late 20th and 21st century. Lovely. Every advance is an objective understanding of the cosmos, and in its technological control further distances the self from the cosmos precisely in the degree of the advance, so that in the end, the self becomes a space-bound ghost, which roams the very cosmos it understands perfectly. In other words, when we try to make up a story for ourselves, and that story is, well, we're just the product of an accident, there is no transcendent moral absolute, and there is no meaning to life, then we just wander around in a cosmos that is vacant. There is no purpose, there is no meaning to life, and so I've got to cobble it together for myself. And the way I use that freedom, that liberation from the Christian story, ends up trapping me further and further into the meaninglessness of this story I've created for myself. When we reject Jesus, we find ourselves trapped in a story we've made up that is a journey of self-discovery and authenticity. But for what? How can you even know what is authentic if there is no concrete, absolute ground of being, of meaning, of value? If you don't know where you come from, you can't know where you're going. You can't know what you're here for. Now, people regularly exclaim that what they see in that world as it is God's indifference to the human tragedy and pain. If only God would appear and accept some responsibility or give some help, then perhaps they would recognize and follow him. But in fact, as this gospel makes clear again and again, he is not indifferent, and he does care, and he couldn't actually care more, because it's because of his care that he came, that he sent his son. And when he came, he was ignored. Even worse, he was rejected, and that's what we see in the next verse. In verse 11, it says, he came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. Now, his own is distadidia. It's a Greek phrase. It's really unique, and it means, or at least in the Gospels, it means his own home, his own property. So the pre-existent son comes as Jesus to the Jewish people. Now, the Jewish people are God's special people. God invited the world into relationship with him, and the world rejected him. And so out of all of the world, in Genesis 12, we learn that he chose one person, Abraham, and said, I'm going to make you into a family that's going to become a great nation. And out of this nation, I will expose myself. I will reveal myself to all humanity. And so that through you, people will know who I am, what I'm like, and can come into my family. And this would be an ever-expanding family of God. But what we see in John 1:11 is that these people not only rejected him time and time again, if you read through your Old Testament, but when he came as his son, they rejected his son. See, if we don't know who we belong to, we also end up feeling lost, lost in the cosmos. If we don't know where we came from, we don't have purpose, we don't have direction. But if we don't even know who we belong to, then we are truly, truly lost. Now, you might say, as a good religious person, I would never do that. But that's what the story is here for. In Genesis 3, everything is perfect, and the humans, Adam and Eve, with nothing wrong, reject God. And then in the Gospels, God's special people, the people who are most primed to recognize and receive their Savior, reject him. What else are these stories doing in the Bible than to humble us and tell us, actually, like, this is what exists in here. This is what we're all prone to. Matthew 23, 29 through 30, Jesus says to the best religious leaders, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our ancestors, we wouldn't have taken part with them in shedding the prophets' blood. Is this not what we do when we say, I would never do that? If you were in the spot of the scribes and Pharisees, highly likely that you would be in the same boat. It's a national rejection. This isn't just every single Jewish person at the time of Jesus rejects Jesus. It's the leaders, the people that represent the nation. And so it's not individual and complete, because we see in the next part that anyone and everyone who receives and believes in the Son is given a part in God's family. But it's religious people. And instead of getting rid of the Christian story, the way that we get rid of the story is we make it about us. We make it about what we believe, so that if we believe the right things, then we are the right kind of people that God loves. We make it about us by making it about what we do, that if we do the right things, if we're the right kind of person, then God will really love us. The way that the world gets rid of the Christian story is it just rejects it outright, but the way that we get rid of it is a little bit more subversive and a little bit more difficult to see. We do it every time we exchange love of God for love of his stuff. When we want to live the resurrection life but are unwilling to go through the death that is required for it. I think for me that is the secret for why so often I fail to live that resurrection life, is I'm unwilling to go through the cross to get it. But you can't be resurrected if you haven't died first. And so we get rid of the Christian story by failing to give up those things that we hold most dear. Maybe it is a sin that we love so much, that we think God couldn't possibly want to take this from me, and I'm unwilling to give it up. Maybe it's a relationship. Maybe it is success. Because at least in our culture, greed certainly seems to pay. And maybe we're not willing to give up the success and financial security that brings. This does something unique to us that Walker Percy hits on. And he says that when we give up the Christian story, we become lost in the cosmos. We become orphans. We don't know where we came from. We don't know where we're going. We don't know who we belong to. And so that leads to feelings of loss and grief. He gives kind of four categories that are common experiences for orphans. There's that deep sense of loss, abandonment, ongoing grief that just doesn't fade away. There's loneliness and isolation, feeling disconnected like an outsider, especially during family-centric events like, I don't know, Christmas. There's identity issues, struggling with belonging and self-worth due to a lack of familial connection. And insecurity, that profound emotional insecurity, fear of abandonment, and difficulty in trusting. Now, that sounds like he's talking about, like, family orphans, people that don't have parents. But what he's talking about is the experience of being lost in a cosmos where we've given up a story that grounds us, we've given up a family that gives us identity and meaning and gives us purpose, and instead exchanged it for a story that's about me and my journey to self-actualization, to becoming my best and most authentic self, to becoming successful, becoming lovable. And I think if you are honest with yourself, you can look and feel those insecure feelings inside. You can see the ways that those play out in your relationships and in your life. It's not just the world out there that is susceptible to this, but that it exists in our heart as a default. And it's something that, like, for Christians, God is intent on doing away with and removing those feelings of isolation, those feelings of fear, those feelings of confusion. So what is said in the next two verses kind of encapsulates the purpose of the gospel as a whole, and in fact, the whole reason John wrote his gospel was that people would believe in Jesus as Messiah, as creator, as the owner, as the family of God, as the owner of the family of God. In verses 12 and 13, it says, But to all who did receive him, he gave them the right to be children of God, to those who believe in his name, who were born not of natural descent or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. And so we see that to find ourselves found in the cosmos requires receiving and believing in Jesus and results in being born again. Born again used to be like a pejorative term people bandied about. I feel like we haven't used it so long that maybe it could have a comeback. Are you a born-again Christian? You know. But to receive means, as this verse indicates, to believe in his name. And it's not just this general idea of, oh yeah, I believe this Jesus guy was the Son of God. But it means that to believe in his name is to believe in who he said he was, what he did, what he taught, what he proclaimed. Receiving him involves accepting the teachings and revelation about God that Jesus brings. And then belief is this Greek word pistis, which is an ambiguous term that means faith and faithfulness. I think the most helpful book I've read on this, actually there's a few, but there's this idea that the most helpful phrase that encapsulates what faith meant in the ancient world is believing allegiance or trusting loyalty. Now, you might get a little bit twitchy because you're in a Protestant church and you're like, hey, faith is by grace through faith in Jesus alone. And yes, that is 100% true. 100% true. But believing allegiance, trusting loyalty, isn't just intellectual assent. It is something that happens as a result of being born again. So faithfulness doesn't make you saved. You don't need to work really hard so that God will love you. God loves you, and then he lives his life out through you. He transforms you as you live life with him and in his community, in this family. Faith yields allegiance to the word, trusts him completely, acknowledges his claims, and confesses him with gratitude. That is what it means to believe and receive. Now, you'll notice there's something that happens to those who believe and receive in this Jesus. It's anyone and everyone. It's anybody that believes gets the right to be called a child of God. The authority, the possibility or ability, it's the legitimate right derived from the competent source, which is God. To anybody, universal scope, anybody that wants it. It doesn't mean everybody is automatically in. It's that the offer is open to anyone. And then all of a sudden, it's this cosmic change in status where you go from being an orphan, lost in the cosmos, to a child of God. Now, John was written in a world where rank and honor were preeminent in importance. And the offer of a change of status was not open to anyone and everyone. You had to be from the right family, have the right associations, do the right things, have the right kind of resources. This offer is open to anybody apart from those because it doesn't depend on them. And then finally, it's this divine origin. Now, John recognizes the complexity of faith, my choice, and election, God's choice, God's action. And he doesn't explain any of it here, which is really great because some of you are coming from a tradition where God makes a choice and there's nothing you can do about it. And if you're elect, you're in. And if you're not, like, there's no amount of evangelism that is possibly going to change anything about that. And in its worst iteration, that means that we just kind of hang out until God sends an elect person to our church, and we're like, oh, cool, glad that God chose you to be in the club, and let's, like, be friends. In its worst iteration, right? Okay? And then some of you are coming from a different tradition, which is, nope, it's all up to you. It's not works, but you have to make a choice, and it's open for anybody. And, you know, you can, like, choose to receive salvation, and you can choose to give it up and lose your salvation. And James doesn't address that theology here. Does that make you uncomfortable? Because you want to feel like, well, I'm making a choice. I have a choice in the matter. And John would say, yes. Yeah, anybody that receives and believes in him. But then says, but this isn't something that human beings decided. It's a decision of God. And the stress is on God's action. That, you know, you become a child of God when you are born again, when you receive and believe in Jesus the Messiah. And this isn't a decision that was natural. This wasn't a decision that is by blood or by birth. You're not born into the church. And so, like, I don't know, teenagers and young folks that are coming here with your family, being born into a Christian family does not give you salvation. You have a choice to make. And the mystery, and I'd say maybe even the miracle, is that God has already made a choice about you. Do you want to respond to that choice? And it's certainly not by the decision of a man, or actually, as the verse says, by a husband. So John rules out a natural birth, a human birth, or the decision of humans as the reason God chooses to give the new birth to those who receive his son. The new birth is not brought about by descent or desire or human power, but by a decision that God has made. I think that when we think about that Christian story that gives life meaning and purpose, that tells us where we came from and who we belong to, that we often think, and I've spent enough time in pastoral meetings to know that we often think that God invites us into a journey, and that it's a journey of discovering what it's like to live new life in him. But ultimately, that story is still about you. That's still a story about you. But when we join God's story, it's a story about him. And so our understanding of what he's inviting us into can often feel like a train wreck. Because our lives are a wreck. Our world is a wreck. We keep on making decisions that hurt and destroy and isolate. A guy named Sam Bush put it like this. He says, life is not a journey, but a train wreck. We may buy ourselves a ticket, climb aboard, and imagine the distant places of our dreams, but we are almost always derailed. And yet, as we wait on the side of the tracks, there remains a hope that there will be a rescue, not by our own strength or sense of direction, but by the one who goes to meet us at the crossroads. And this is the story you've joined if you follow Jesus. He left his luxurious heavenly throne for a one-star stable. He traveled by foot up and down the region of Galilee, traveling all the way into the far country of sin and death. The gospel, after all, is not about our journey to God, but God's journey to us. And that's what it takes to bring people into the family of God. It's not just your decision, but God's decision previously to it. God's decision about you. See, if God just left us on our own and said, well, you have to make a decision about my son, I think we would find ourselves in the place of the world or the place of the Pharisees. We'd find ourselves unable to make that decision because we're confused, because we don't understand the story that we are a part of. And so we find ourselves lost and orphaned. But if the story of God is about a God who cares so much and loves us so much that he would come into the world of sin and death, then it's the story of a God that is intent on finding you, that he'd punch a hole in the universe and come into the story as a human being to experience all of the worst that we have to offer. The strange thing, I think, about this passage is it kind of outlines the Christian story. The Christian story is essentially God created a beautiful world. Humans rejected it. And so he came as a little baby, helpless, vulnerable, and allowed himself to be killed on our behalf. And that Even though we did the worst we could, through his indestructible life, he was raised to new life. And he opened a way in for people to be in the family of God by blood. And that one day he will return to make all things right and all things new. It's the creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And that's what I see in this passage. The Word created a beautiful world, and he was not recognized, he was not received. And so God sent his Son to make a way for people to be born again. Anybody who would receive him, anyone who would believe. In the book of Genesis, we read that God created a beautiful world and that he created humans to share it with. He wanted to create a family, people that would rule this world with him and spread his love and his life to the edges of the world, to discover the latent potential he'd hidden into things, and to make things with it, and to bring out his beauty and creativity in our life and in our work. But in Genesis 3, we see that human beings decided, I've got a better story that I want to be a part of. I'm going to choose what's right and good in my own eyes. And so they rejected. They refused to recognize. They rejected the good God who created a beautiful world. And so through the history and tragedy of humanity, God continued to institute a rescue plan to the point where it got so bad that he'd had enough. And I think that's what the fullness of time means. In the fullness of time, when God couldn't stand to watch the people he loved any longer wander around as confused orphans in the cosmos, he sent his Son. And he sent his Son to tell us a story that is more worthy of belonging to than the ones that we concoct on our own. And we decided we didn't like that story either, and so we killed him. And God accepted his sacrifice on our behalf and raised him to new life on the third day so that anybody that would believe in him wouldn't perish. Wouldn't perish alone, wouldn't perish as an orphan, but instead would be welcomed by blood into the family of God. And what else does it mean that we're family than that we are blood relatives? Not by human decision or natural descent, but by the blood of the God who loves us. And that he's forming a family, that the church is a family, and that we live out his life now. Galatians 2:20 says, like, when we receive and believe in this Jesus, we are crucified with him. The old me is dead. And the life that we now live, we live because of and for and in the God who loved me and died for me. There's a book for teenagers based off of Luther's Shorter Catechism, and a very intelligent guy named Gerhard Ferdy wrote the introduction, and it's super long. It's like 3 pages, and I can't possibly read that all to you guys now, but it starts off like this. God has made a decision about you. He hasn't waited to find out how sincere you are, how devout or religious you might be, or how well you understand the Bible and the catechism. He hasn't even waited to find out if you are interested or willing to take this decision seriously. He has simply decided. And if that decision, if God's decision on your behalf sounds good, it means freedom. Not the kind of freedom where you reject the story and get to live however you want, but where you discover the Christian story is the story you actually belong to already, and it's the one you are meant to live. And you find your freedom not in being free from, but free for the truth, free for the way and life that Jesus Christ offers. And so if you accept and receive and believe in God's decision in his Son, then you are free indeed. Let me pray. Father, thank you that you have made a decision about us. And that whether we accept that decision or reject it, your decision means that you care, you're beautiful, and you love us, and that we can find freedom in you. I pray that you would meet with us now as we respond to your word with song. that you'd meet us where we're at and speak in the ways that we need to hear. Help us to live out the story that you've invited us into, and to find that the freedom you offer is better than anything we would wish to exchange it for. We give you this time, knowing that you are present and care. Amen.